This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a GHIL joint lecture in cooperation with the Modern History Seminar at the University of Oxford, given by Stephanie Middendorf, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at the Friedrich Schiller University Jena, on societies under siege, experiencing states of emergency in the long 20th century. Today, the state of emergency seems to be as permanent as it is omnipresent. The term became ubiquitous in the early 20th century and continues to guide the self-description of contemporary societies. Yet, referring to emergencies implies a large range of meanings, from actual states of war to moments of humanitarian crisis, from abstract realms of the law to concrete territories under siege. The lecture argues for a history of emergency experiences in the long 20th century that reaches beyond classical theories and focuses on the social dimensions of administrative agency instead. It treats the state of emergency as an imaginary that informs technocratic practices and legal theory at the same time, and argues that historicizing it can help us to understand the critical role of the state apparatus in moments of transformation.
Thank you so much for the invitation and for the very friendly presentation. And Christian mentioned the word experiment, and this is, I think, fits very nicely to what I'm trying to do tonight by presenting something which is meant as a reflection on the possibilities and also maybe dangers of writing a social history of states of exception. So it's a preliminary presentation. It's not the result of something that is finished, but it's sort of an essayistic approach. And I will start this quote by the French Christian priest, anti-colonial activist, and former member of the Résistance, Albert Hou, from a debate on a new emergency law in the French Parliament in April 1955. And he said, why resort to what is called a state of emergency as serious as a state of siege? Why pass a law of exception? I consider this extremely serious, both in terms of principle and psychologically. So as this quote indicates, I think the state of exception addresses a social state, not only a legal one, contains psychological, social and cultural dimensions and results from complex processes of negotiation and decision-making. It is not a single state, but a bundle of intermingled and related states, states of exception, states of emergency, states of siege. And I will return to those concepts later. And I think our current experience probably relates also to this very easily, as for the past 4 weeks, varieties of the state of exception have gained a new relevance in Israel, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank, following Hamas and Hezbollah attacks on Israeli civilians on October 7, Benjamin Netanyahu called on the opposition to form an emergency government on the same day a state of siege was declared over the Gaza Strip. And in a TED Talk, political analyst Ian Bremmer described the mental state of the Israeli society as that of a besieged society. So these various terms are used in these days, also state of emergency, state of war, state of siege, meant different things. And nevertheless were related closely to one another as a field of action and also as a field of interpretation and how to interpret these conflicts. And previously, moreover, academic framings of Israel as a permanent state of exception had become widespread. And since the beginning of October, these more intellectual attributions now collided on various levels with the violent reality. So my lecture will address the question of how one can empirically trace this complexity of the experience of states of exception in modern society and to what extent specific governmental techniques have emerged from this history of experience. And I think as we have all witnessed in recent years, also beyond Israel, that the state of exception is a condition that can take very different forms, a term that outlines a broader semantic field rather than a specific context. And at the same time, I think much like the concept of crisis, it is somehow omnipresent and seems to have a saline meaning for the self-description of the present. And as this Google Engram slide shows, the increasing use of the term state of exception can be observed since the late 20th century, a boom that continues to this day and took off mainly with the US war on terror after 9/11. This event served as an impetus for a broader theoretical debate on democratic governance in a state of exception. Yet the fact that already in the 1990s, 94% of conflicts fought with armed force were intrastate conflicts or conflicts, projected conflicts in spaces without clear-cut state borders, rather than classic wars between national states, had already spurred the interest in this topic before that, as well as the fact that mainly Latin American societies and also Middle Eastern states have made use of states of emergency already from the 1970s and 80s onwards. So already in 1978, a study that had estimated that at least 30 of the 150 countries then in existence were in a state of emergency, and the 1986 interim report to the International Law Association found that approximately 70 states were at the time undergoing some type of emergency. Yet many of these emergencies were not formally declared or were defined as such by those people that were writing these reports. So it's not so always so clear to know what exactly is meant by these categories. Yet since then, a line of research has solidified that understands the state of exception following Giorgio Agamben, who can be seen on the slide, as a new paradigm of governance in the presence. And, a wide variety of spaces and times are related under this paradigmatic framing, from Nazi concentration camps to practices of protective custody in Guantanamo, from colonial counterinsurgency to German hazard defense in the early 21st century. And the interwar, the European interwar period, and especially the transition between Weimar democracy and National Socialist dictatorship, where I come from and where my interest in this topic comes from, regularly serve as exemplar of this state of exception. And described by Agamben as a legalized civil war, the democratic emergency measures taken by the Weimar government before Hitler came to power are then linked to the dictatorial practices of violence implemented afterwards by the Nazi government, and in this historically questionable connections are then elevated to the status of important for contemporary societies, being permanently, as Agamben insinuates also in this quote, in the state of a global civil war. And because of this paradigmatic framing, the state of exception is now considered by some historians of the global to be kind of a gold standard to measure the significance of state violence also in colonial context and to provide for their historical relevance, not least in comparison to the crimes of the Shoah. Since Agamben had elevated Auschwitz to the paradigmatic side of modernity, claiming it to be the ultimate state of exception. And relating to that, Dina Hertz, for example, has argued on the basis of her research on states of exception and famine politics in India since the 18th century, and I quote her here, "We can therefore trace what Agamben views as the political space of modernity not to Nazi concentration camps, but to biopolitical welfare measures in the colonies that transformed centers of famine relief into extermination camps in which millions of men, women, and children were abandoned or let die." Somewhat less pointedly, Stephen Morton has argued that an analysis of colonial emergencies allows us to understand the historical and political processes by which the state of exception or state of emergency came to be a global political condition, and that the historical experience of those who were forced to live under conditions of colonial violence question and complicate universalizing knowledge claims about democracy and the rule of law in Western political thought. So this analysis also aims at questioning Western values and Western conceptions of history. And its analytical foundation is the assumption that there is some kind of global political condition of regimes of exception, which are dominated by the West, where originally experienced not in Europe, not in Germany, but in the colonies, and meanwhile to found worldwide. So, and the history of German dictatorship and measures of emergency governance in global and post-colonial spaces are indeed connected in some respects, and I will elaborate on that also a little bit today. But I think it's problematic and doubtful whether a semantically shimmering and highly abstract paradigm of the state of exception as devised by a government in the 1990s is really suitable for placing our kind and our different kinds of spaces of experience in a meaningful historical relationship or for hierarchizing their significance. So my goal today is not to argue for a global history of the state of exception in the long 20th century, rather to reflect on possible ways in which historical experiences of this specific state can be grasped in their particular context and then related to one another and within a broader conceptual development, with the intention to better understand the social history and the evolution of this governmental technique, not with the aim of somehow streamlining or binding together a wide variety of historical context in the wake framework of a global history of exceptional violence. And I will rely primarily on French and German examples for pragmatic reasons and because those are the two societies I've been working on more deeply, but also because it allows to connect in some ways the history of the Holocaust and colonial history. And in the first part of my presentation, I will argue and try to show that the state of exception is not a clear-cut instrument, that the central concepts and the different terms need to be placed within a longer history of conceptual evolution and transformation to really understand what is meant by them at a specific point in time. And in the second step, I will argue that the state of exception is not a clear-cut instrument of violence in the hands of the powerful, but results from conflicting interests and also from social mindsets. And in order to really write a social history of this state of affairs, we need to take those mindsets and experience into account. But first, I try to begin with a pop cultural representation of the state of emergency stemming from Edward Zwick's 1998 film, The Siege. What I wanted to address with this snippet from this blockbuster is that at the core of the social history of the state of exception, I think there is the practice of drawing lines. And in Bruce Willis' declaration of martial law in this brief scene, it seemingly defines the frontier where the state of peace ends, at least for a certain part of the population, drawing an invisible line around an explicitly described ethnic and generational group, as well as around a specific urban territory, Brooklyn. And it also emphasizes the decisiveness of this act, its military character, and the uncompromisingness. So this might be what we have in mind when thinking of a state of exception. But I would like to contrast it with other associations stemming from historical material related to the experience of the French state of emergency in the 1950s, also by those responsible and involved in the practice of putting it into practice. And this is the association with a permanent uncertainty, especially the uncertainty about frontiers and boundaries. And this experience of uncertainty and lack of clearness, I think, can be exemplified here by a quote from French publisher Jérôme Mindon, stemming from an open letter he wrote dealing with the question of insubordination under the French colonial state of emergency that was declared over Algeria in the 1950s. The letter was published in Le Monde in 1960 and said, "Disobedience is a crime, you say, until it becomes a duty. But the problem remains for a young Frenchman worthy of the name to know where in this war is the fateful frontier at which one ceases to represent a model of patriotism and becomes the perpetrator of infamy. If there is a frontier, where is it?" And then another French contemporary, the young Michel Foucault, in his report on resettlement camps in Algeria, published in 1959, simply called the French state of emergency at the time, I quote him, "the absence of any clearly defined policy." So the state of conception is thus a concept of liminality. And historically, however, it did not primarily concern, as one might assume maybe today, the boundary between normality and exceptionality, that is a social demarcation, nor the boundary between violence and law, which would be a juridical setting, but it's in its very core, the state of exception marked the distinction between peace and war by legal, political, and later also social means. And I will come back to that. So this distinction also included the attempt to differentiate between violence legitimized by war and other forms of legitimate violence in specific, temporarily, and territorially defined contexts. And to have a brief sketch of the longer history of this, these related concepts, I think that the modern state of exception was rooted or can be rooted in the revolutionary moment of 1789 and the ongoing civilization of martial law in the 19th century, which in turn replaced earlier absolutist emergency practices. And the corresponding decree of 1791 described a tension between states of peace, war, and siege, each resulting in different rights of intervention for commanders. And in this structure, the état de siège, the state of siege, was the state between war and peace, in which, and I quote from a contemporary dictionary, the military purposes and needs override all other considerations in such a way that even for the civilian population, the military power, the laws of war, martial laws, and cour martial take the place in whole or in part of civil laws and normal judicial and administrative authorities. And depending on its spatial extent and the group against it was directed, the state could be a military state of siege, which then could turn into a full state of war, or it could serve as a political state of siege to combat insurrections in limited territories, thus oscillating between these military and civilian or military and political categories. So in a state of siege, war was not officially declared, but an analogy of war, that was the term of the time, was created in internal spaces, which permitted the comprehensive suspension of normal, that is civilian, authorities and applicable laws. And this state of siege that emerged from the French Revolution was later shaped into a French Republican legal institution by laws from 1849 and 1887, and was not fundamentally altered again until after World War II, then as already addressed in the context of the war of decolonization in Algeria. And already since the late 18th century, forms of appropriation and transfer of this new legal state could also be observed in colonial territories, as my colleague Amerigo Caruso, who is currently writing the second book on this topic, can show for Guadeloupe and Martinique, for example. In Germany, on the other side, the Prussian law on the state of siege of June 1841 was decisive and remained influential well into the 20th century. Here, executive power passed from the king or emperor to local military authorities, and under certain conditions, this could also result into a state of the whole nation that is no longer defined or concentrated on specific regional territories. On the other hand, the exceptional measures imposed on individual districts in the German Empire on the basis of the Socialist Act, the Sozialistengesetze in the late 19th century, were referred to as a minor state of siege, a kleine Belagerungszustand, and this is what this cartoon is about, mocking how civilians could become suspects for more or less ridiculous reasons related to a seemingly military appearance. And this is under the heading of kleine Belagerungszustandsbilder, because it was this small, minor state of siege concentrated on very specific territories. These developments in turn incorporated the French tradition of loi d'exception, or Ausnahmegesetze in the German framing since about the 1820s, which were used to suspend civil liberties in the restoration period. So there was a transfer of French-German transfer of legal concepts already at the time. The state of exception, as we might, as the idea we might have of it today as a political condition of its own kind, was described in more detail only after World War I, most notably by Carl Schmitt, who somehow needs to appear in every lecture on the state of exception and also in mine. And he developed a peculiar concept of state sovereignty that in its highly antagonistic categories remained intellectually in a state of war. In order to polemicize against the constitutional efforts of the Weimar Republic, Schmitt, in the tradition of pre-modern notions of state necessity, emphasized the supposedly indispensable detachment of the state of exception from the bourgeois realm of law, and transferred these notions into a kind of decisionist metaphysics remote from law. But this detachment of the state of exception from the law was a Schwittian fiction. So fact were the provisions of the Reich's constitution, which in the famous Article 48 had created a constitutional state that was at once definite and indefinite. The constitution, Article 48, provided for the authorization of the Reich's president in situations that endangered public security and order, öffentliche Sicherheit und Ordnung, but referred for more detailed provisions to an imperial law, which that then was never passed, contrary to France or Austria, for example. And what was new about this legal condition was the concept of order to be, this was a new term, to be secured by extraordinary measures. And at the same time, the state of siege, as defined in the 19th century, was removed from the German constitution altogether. So ultimately, this remained all rather vague, but what was actually understood as a sort of continuation of the state of war in times of peace, although the state of exception temporarily, especially in the 1930s, took on a more civilian character as a method of German political and economic crisis management. It became sort of a civic concept of emergency measures in times of economic crisis. And this like a transformative element from a state of war or a state in between peace and war to a state of crisis management was then took up, especially after 1945, when the state of emergency, or in French, the état d'urgence, and German, the Staatsnotstand, was conceived. Here are some examples from the contemporary discussion after 1945. The state of emergency, as it was then called, no longer state of exception, but state of emergency, asserted itself as a distinguished concept in various European societies at about the same times. And again, there were a lot of transfers and observations of developments in other countries. And simultaneously, which is interesting, the state of war, which had been part of constitutional law since the 19th century as well, lost significance or migrated to a body of international law. And in international law, the concept of war was increasingly avoided, and instead it was spoken of international armed conflicts of various kinds that were fought not only between states. So this transformation somehow reflected changes in modern warfare and in modern statehood at the same time, but also the emergence of humanitarian interventionism, which was designed to intervene already when so-called measures short of war, so before war, were observed, so even in peacetime. So the idea of emergency, this changed understanding, was related to the changed understanding of the state of war in international law and shaped the ways in which different national states of emergency were then conceptualized in the French and also in the German case and in other cases as well. And the German Basic Law and the Grundgesetz, the state of emergency, later in the 1960s, completely replaced the states of war, siege, and exception. And in other cases, such as in France, on which I will concentrate a little bit more, it was given, the state of emergency was given its own form, which continued to exist next to the classic state of siege and exceptional dictatorial powers given to the French president in Article 16 of the French Constitution from 1958. Somehow took up the German conception of state of exception as meant by Carl Schmitt in the interwar period. But the état d'urgence, the state of emergency in the French understanding, put the public order at the center. Again, this term, there was no mention of security anymore in this legal concept, and it brought a range of new possibilities for action to the French state. And these became relevant in the sort of modernization French decolonization war was also framed as. These included forms of collective punishment and internment, as well as the practice of refusing to recognize the military combatant status to the opponent, thus deliberately excluding the persons concerned by state interventions from the existing protective mechanisms of international law in cases of war. Whereas in the 19th century, deported populations in the colonies had been explicitly designated as prisoners of war in order to be able to treat them as military opponents, now the opposite mechanism was somehow evident. Recognition of combatants as prisoners of war was denied by declaring a state of emergency in order to be able to deny the corresponding protection under international law. And against this specific background, one of the editors of a clandestine collection of testimonies on torture from the Algerian War, which was published in France in 1959 under the title La Gangrène, put it this way. Strict laws were enacted to protect prisoners of war, but not just anyone can be a belligerent. Your adversary must still consider it in his interest to recognize you as such. As for the rebel, he cannot benefit from the guarantees of international law. So on this basis and with this framework, the état d'urgence, the state of emergency established in several steps in Algeria in 1955, both avoided the state of war and extended beyond the fight against sedition or resistance as possible under the traditional state of siege. It empowered the civil authorities, not the military, and it was officially intended to secure a common good or a good life, le salut public, and to meant or framed to reduce inequalities and implement reforms as a means to weaken Algerian nationalism. So for this reason, too, the corresponding arsenal of governmental interventions could be used to frame even brutal measures of counterinsurgency as defensive tactics of the French welfare state. And in the parliamentary discussion about the état d'urgence, which was introduced by law then in April 1955, the responsible rapporteur, Jacques Chanton, accordingly made it clear that the new state of emergency was no longer to be primarily related to warlike conflicts or to a border between peace and war. It should be an expression of a change towards primacy of the civil and I quote him here, an intermediary between a normal situation and a state of siege. And this emphasis of normality and welfare state obligations, as well as the recourse to a certain idea of modernity, le monde moderne, were new elements that had not previously appeared in the discussions or provisions of the state of exception or state of siege. And I think they demonstrate the intertwining between this social and political history of the state of exception and the broader transformation of state-society relations in the 20th century. So although the French bill was de facto justified by a warlike situation in the Algerian independence struggles, according to Jeantin, it expressed a much more fundamental need in French society, the expectation of state provision for existence. And this expectation was also frequently brought up in the French National Assembly when debating these new laws on the state of emergency, from which I will quote one Algerian deputy, Ali Kadi, a member of the Democratic and Socialist Union of the Resistance. He said, a state of emergency, yes, but against the appalling poverty that reigns in Algeria. A state of emergency, yes, but against hunger, against the undernourishment of 3 million Muslims with barely 1,500 calories a day, which made a colonel in charge of repression say, it's hardly for me to send lead into hollow stomachs, into starving stomachs. State of emergency, yes, against unemployment. So in this understanding, the state of emergency was no longer considered a disguised state of war, and thus a question of military security, but a state of crisis and état de crise, that was also a slogan that came up in the discussion, understood as a question of social ordering, which required not military reaction, but political prevention. And interestingly, Carl Schmitt, living in the western part of Germany at the time, formulated something very similar shortly thereafter, 2 years after the implementation of the French state of emergency, in a postscript to one of his earlier texts from the Weimar years, republished in 1957, stating that the administrative state of the modern mass public services must not, however, allow such an open state of exception to break out. It must not wait for the crisis, which could become fatal, in order to suppress it repressively, but must prevent it in advance. The classic state of exception, as he himself had conceived it in the 1920s, now seems old-fashioned. And following this since the 1960s, you can observe an increasing transition between the concepts of crisis and the concept, diverse concepts of states of emergency. And this is a tendency, I think, that is still predominant today, at least in the societies that are not actually involved in an open state of war. And these specific kinds of emergency crisis powers were then also adjusted to different national situations, which I won't follow today, but integrated into a wide range of legal and constitutional settings, and also inscribed into humanitarian law and into the human rights regimes that are still in power today, thus becoming normalized in a sense. And a report prepared for the United Nations in 1997 found that between 1985 and 1997, some 100 states of, or territories, that is over half the member states of the United Nations, had at some point been under a state of emergency. This report pointed out that, I quoted here, if the list of countries which have proclaimed, extended, or terminated a state of emergency in this period were to be projected onto a map of the world, the resulting area would cover nearly 3/4 of the Earth's surface. And this map, drawn by colleagues from the social sciences, attempts to visualize this idea of a map of emergency, but as one can see, it shows not 3/4 of the Earth's surface, but a much more reduced sample of countries, but it only shows those states of emergency that were officially reported according to the rules of the United Nations human rights regime. So it's always a question of definition and what exactly is being put under this category. And I will stop here with regard to this sort of overview on the development of the social history of concepts and sort of trying to put it down. Since for wartime societies, it has been argued that there is a specific form of modern societies characterized by a strong despotic state, central control, individual unfreedom, strict subordination of the individual, military value systems. And for societies in a state of exception, I think it can be stated that they also have their historical place in modernity and they are related, that the history of the state is related to the history of modernity. They are characterized by a strong reference to constitutional law and legal thinking, an unclear liminal situation between war and peace that can be resolved militarily or politically, and in the second half of the 20th century by the idea of securing a social order that meant more than securing state sovereignty or defending the nation. And societies under siege, as I would call them, are thus not societies of pure or arbitrary violence, although they are certainly societies that are historically marked by the experience of war-related and other violence. But just another sentence before I come to the second part of my presentation. I think that the state of exception, as I would understand it, is in this respect neither a moment in which violence explodes that was previously contained, nor a legal mechanism to contain or combat extra legal violent practices, but needs to be described rather as an open, inherently conflicting social condition somewhere between war and peace that was partially transformed into a socially and culturally defined state of abnormality after the two world wars, in part due to international legal developments and transfers of knowledge. And to that extent, it actually has an entangled and also global history that contributed to the evolution and to the history of this technique. But how this concept became effective in forms of violence or state intervention or social or individual reactions, I think, depended on mental and spatial conditions, which must be observed on a more on smaller scales and be written as micro histories rather than global movements. And I will try to attempt that in that the following second and shorter part of my presentation, which tries to address some, certainly not all, aspects that might constitute something like a social dimension of a state of exception and might be empirical categories in order to come closer to what experiences and emergency mindsets might be. And I will again start with a quote. Last week, for example, we had an operation as if we were part of the army. The gentlemen from the government say there is no war in Algeria and that the forces of order, that is, police, must restore calm. But there is a war in Algeria, and when they finally realize it, it will be too late. What gets me most is the torture. Can you imagine what that means? I sometimes torture for 10 hours in a row. And it is in his book, The Wretched of the Earth, which is also on the slide, Les Damnés de la Terre, that Franz Fanon documents this statement by a French policeman who suffered from a psychotic disorder after serving in the Algerian War of Decolonization. The man sought medical help after he began beating his wife and children. In the medical interview, he described the state of emergency officially prevailing in Algeria at the time as a borderline experience in which his own role was unclear. As a policeman, he was forced, as he put it, to play infantry, that is to act like a soldier. And from the medical treatment, he expected counseling that would enable him to better justice to his violent activity and produce or act more successfully in terms of the confessions to be obtained by church torture. So this complex experience of petty sovereigns, as Judith Butler had called them, also had to do with the question of what role they were assumed to be playing in a state of emergency and whether they could be sure of this role. Such forms of performative clarification of one's own rule have also been shown by Matthew Hughes in his study on the British pacification in Palestine in the 1930s, where soldiers disguised themselves as policemen in order to enforce measures of emergency rule, thus giving their acts a supposedly civilian face, as well as themselves a physical form somehow, which made it easier to enact illegal violence. And the practice of giving advance warning by trumpet blast, also Matthew Hughes has documented, that British soldiers used before Arab houses were destroyed, might be similar in that question of how to grasp the performative meaning of a state of emergency and the uncertainty and openness it involves for those responsible for putting the violent practices into on the local population. So we can look at mechanisms and practices that were chosen by agents to legitimize emergency measures while managing the uncertainties and the emotions that resulted from this unclear, weakly legitimized and shifting state of liminality. As Mania Lasbec has put it in her study on torture under the French colonial regime, it was often fear that led to actions under the emergency rule. Yet this fear was not only a subjective reaction, but, I quote her here, grounded in the ever-present sense of the political precariousness of colonial rule under the conditions of an emergency law, because it was fundamentally unjust. So psychological reactions, as well as fear and other emotions, linked individual effectiveness to structural conditions of emergency rule, and which I would think would be a definition of the term experience, is this interrelation between subjective or individual experiences and some kind of structural dimensions. And this, of course, relates to Reinhard Koselleck's philosophy of history and his understanding of the history of experience. And in this sense, I think also the state of experience can be conceptualized as a space of experience in which past and future are also intertwined and historical time is thematized. So this is the second element beyond uncertainty, is a temporality as an element of the experiential history of states of exception. And looking at the aforementioned French and German parliamentary debates, one can observe that references to time or temporality were regularly of importance. For example, when Article 48 was passed, the members of parliament in Weimar argued about whether the inclusion of the term order, as I mentioned, it was the new term, which was seen by its supporters as an expression of the democratic identity of the new state, was not rather a capitulation to the old militarism in the administrative apparatus. That is, whether it described a step forward or a step backwards in time. And both the French and German politicians, civil servants, and others involved in legislative discussions reflected on and debated whether and what form fundamental categories such as order or law had changed historically. And in both countries, the contemporary experience of fascism or totalitarian dictatorship was also brought to mind in this context. And even more so as the step that was taken in France in 1955, as well as in West Germany in 1968, that is the empowerment of civil authorities and the police at the expense of military forces, in some points actually resembled the conception of the state of exception as declared by the Nazi government in February 1933, because it also empowered the Reichsgovernment itself as opposed to military commanders. As an example, one of many of this reflection of temporality, which might be worthwhile having a closer look at, were the diaries of the German State Secretary of Finance, whom I encountered in my study on the Reichsministry of Finance, Stefan, who drafted himself large parts of the Weimar emergency policy in the financial realm from 1930 to 1932, and was also quite familiar with Schmidt's writings. And he came to the conclusion that the Reichsnotstandspolitik was legitimate because, and I quote here from his diaries, general forms of legislation had changed in view of the gravity of the times. The Zeitverhältnisse was his term, and therefore a different legal consciousness had emerged. Schäfer actually remained firmly rooted in constitutional and democratic procedures, and experts and intellectuals like him were later also involved in the heated post-45 debates on a new German emergency regime, like Eugen Kogon, Ernst Fraenkel, and Wolfgang Abendroth. Yet the structural quality of emergency experiences in causalic sense could also lead to the perpetuation and normalization of more radical techniques which were grounded in emergency powers and later also circulated among other transnational epistemic communities. And this, for example, connects Schäfer's contemporary and also adversary Carl Schmitt to French warfare in the 1950s and 60s. The generals of the Organisation Armée Secrète, who like Raoul Salon and others, rebelled against de Gaulle's rule of the état d'urgence, the state of emergency, from 1958 onwards, were idealized by Schmitt in his 1962 theory of the partisan, which can be seen on the left side of the slide in the French translation, as passionate opponents of an outmoded rule of law. Schmitt stated that with its actions in Algeria, this constitutional French state had torn apart, as he put it, the normative fabric of legality, and thus produced people without rights, rechtlos gemachte, who passionately defended themselves against the superior state. Because the French civilian government somehow had, in the moment of emergency, tried to put on a uniform and elevated itself to the status of a quasi-military commander, its leading generals, Schmidt argued, were now forced to follow the inexorable logic of partisan warfare. In pacified West Germany, where he himself lived, Schmidt considered the state of emergency he himself, or the state of exception he himself had defined in 1922, as old-fashioned, as we have heard. But in France, a country that continued to wage wars, he found opportunities to further develop his theories. And it was here that a specific experiential knowledge of colonial warriors emerged, which was subsequently communicated internationally in the form of lectures and books and military advisors and instructions at military academies around the world. And men like Salon, Bussarès, Jacques Massu, Trinquier, who is also on the slide, or David Galula, look back on long careers in various colonial war zones, as well as in World War II resistance, and embodied a mental permanence of the state of war even after 1945. And this mindset tended to be sidelined in the legislative approaches and civilization efforts of the French National Assembly, and it's the debate it led about the état d'urgence. But nonetheless, I think this circulation of knowledge among torture experts, detention camps, organizers, and military advisors would need to be explored in more detail. And I think there are still many traces to be discovered, after all, as Indian colonial officials carried their knowledge to the German occupation administration after 1945. As Camilo Ehrlichmann has shown, French fighters of the resistance, like those on the slide, carried their experience to Algeria and then to the world, and former Wehrmacht soldiers sold their knowledge to the Foreign Legion. But finally, as a last step, I would like to look at the confrontation between the mindsets of the rulers, or the petty sovereigns on the one side, and the ruled. And I will switch the geographic location for a last time and go to August 1943, to the situation in Denmark, where the Reichsplenipotentiary Werner Best, also an avid reader of Schmidt's writings, imposed on Hitler's instruction a state of exception, and Ausnahmezustand in that case, on the Danish territory, which until then had been controlled by the Germans only in the form of indirect rule. This declaration was intended to advance, I quote, the solution of the Jewish question and the Masonic question in Denmark. And in this situation, Best competed with the military commander Hermann von Hanneken, with Hanneken being the profiteer of the declaration of the state of exception because it empowered the military. Best then asked the regime, or the leadership, to enable him to form his own executive body and legitimize this as the easiest way, I quote him, to abruptly arrest and transport away 6,000 Jewish persons, including women and children. The main issue here was the competition between the civilian, in a sense, state represented by the security police and BEST, and on the other hand, the military state controlled by the Wehrmacht. Thus, specific lines of conflict within the National Socialist state were expressed. But on the other hand, this imposition of the state of exception set in motion its own developments, because immediately after the declaration, many Jews left their homes and fled into hiding or abroad. That is, the very act of deciding on this state of exception unleashed clandestine communications, rumors, and diffuse fears that led to action and also to resistance by the Danish government to these practices. And as other self-testimonies from other areas of National Socialist occupation, as well as findings from colonial context by the aforementioned Stephen Morton, show that the imposition of a state of exception or emergency was seen by those affected not least as an indication that the existing rule might be fragile, that not, and I quote here, the diary of Eva Rupikova from 1941, that not everything works out as the German claims, as the Germans claim. And this perception of the state of exception as a moment of contingency could, on the side of the rule, promote the decision to flee or to resist. At the same time, however, it could trigger fears and exhaustion because it could be assumed that a radicalization of violence was imminent. A craftsman from a small Polish town, for example, wrote in August 1942 that the declaration of a state of exception, which had taken place shortly before, was not connected to any concrete regulations or restrictions. And so for him, rather, this act served solely to give the police forces the opportunity, I quote his letter, to shoot people with impunity for any random stupidity, and to use the resulting uncertainty among the population to murder more Jews and rob their possessions. Thus, not only the specific legal condition of the peculiar coexistence of military and civilian actors, but also the perception of the population had, and I think still has, decisive significance for the effect that this state of affairs can have or not have on societies and their mindset. I think it would be worthwhile to dig a little deeper into that direction. I come to the conclusion now. And as you can imagine, based on these really preliminary observations and this work in progress, it is not possible to come to some sort of an ambiguous conclusion. But I would like to state two things, maybe finally, that the diachronic look at the conceptual history, which I tried in the first part of the paper, can make visible that war and peace have always somehow defined the realms in which state of exception was historically rooted. And in order to further explore this historical framework, it might be helpful to research in more detail the possible effects that a more military or a more civilian understanding of the state of exception or state of emergency can have on respective societies and the implementation of state violence in the long 20th century, and that other boundaries, like, for example, between security and order, public or private, or national and international law, could then be related to that sort of continuum between state of peace and state of war. And second, were more synchronic and comparative analysis of different spaces of the state of exception, it becomes apparent that from this act of demarcation, of drawing a line, very different and diverse practices of governance, as well as different governmentalities in a way can emerge. And that these were influenced by feelings of uncertainty and threat, perception of time and history, knowledge transfers, overarching national boundaries, and conflicting experiential spaces that could emerge the very moment a state of exception was announced. And for the very last point, in places of total and eliminatory violence, however, where it was all about extermination, these categories and concepts hardly applied, I think. And so in Auschwitz, there was no need to declare a state of exception. And to my mind, this makes it not very plausible to describe Auschwitz as the paradigmatic state of exception in modernity, but we can use this concept to describe other liminal areas between war and peace, or violence and non-violence, or the rule of law and the suspension. This would be my final remark.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.